Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, good morning. A few weeks ago, you might remember, I had Jonty Bush on as a guest on Conversations. When we were done on the way out of the studio, Jonty pulled me aside and said, "You've got to talk to Sam Cawthorn." Sam Cawthorn is the Tasmanian Young Australian of the Year for this year. And when he met Kevin Rudd, Sam played a lovely prank on Kevin that the Prime Minister said he's still recovering from, and it makes Sam officially a legend in my book. Sam's in the motivation business, and he's very good at it. Even though he's a young guy, he's a father of three kids. His parents migrated to Australia from India before he was born. And although Sam had a quite strict religious upbringing, he went a little bit off the rails for a while as a teenager until he met the woman who became his wife. Well, that was one turning point in Sam's life. The next one was an absolutely dreadful car accident that cost Sam literally an arm and almost a leg. He was pieced back together, and although he still lives with his injuries, he travels around Australia and the world and will occasionally score a decent upgrade on his seat from the airline. Sam Cawthorn, good morning.
Good morning, good morning.
I just want to get the story of that prank with the Prime Minister. You do have a prosthetic arm at the moment, and it's a fine thing. Tell me, who put you up to this prank to begin with?
Well, I was talking to my little girl, Amelia. Now, she's 6 years old. She's the gorgeous thing, and she just loves having lots of fun. She can just see the world in a complete different set of eyes. And so we were just having a conversation before I went up to Canberra for the Australia Day Awards. And I actually said to her, admittedly, I said, "Look, do you dare me, Amelia, to take my hand off when the Prime Minister goes to shake my hand? Because I've got this very cool silver arm. It's a Myo Electric, which is a bionic arm. It all works via 7 motors all in it, and it just looks really cool. And you can actually also detach the hand, even though the hand looks exactly the same as my other hand. It's dark skin and the same type of nails. And when I've got a long sleeve shirt on, it even looks exactly like my other hand. When people go to shake my hand, I can detach the entire hand off when they go to shake it." So it was hilarious. We went up there. I was very nervous. I was sweating a little bit before, and I'm thinking, will I do it? Won't I do it? Will I do it? You know, we all get in those two frame of minds. And
but you weren't going to die wondering, were you?
That's exactly right. You only live once.
Yeah. So what happened when the Prime Minister shook your hand and it detached in his hand? What actually happened?
Yeah, look, basically, we're all lining up to meet the Prime Minister going into his house in the lodge. And so as I went to shake his hand, my hand actually detached and obviously ended up in his hand. It was just very, very funny.
In that first moment, was there horror on the Prime Minister's face? Perfect horror? Was he spellbound for a second?
Look, he was. There was a very, very quick half a second where his face just dropped. And I reckon he turned whiter than white.
And then?
And then from there, he just absolutely cracked up laughing. His wife, Therese, was standing right there next to him. Also, Adam Gilchrist. They just started cracking themselves up laughing. And then the PM, he actually then told me a story how he had one of his members of staff, he had a prosthetic leg, and regularly that guy would get a fork and stick a fork right into his leg. And he was telling me all these stories so he could fully see the joke side of things.
I love that. And I just want to quote here from the Prime Minister's speech. He said, "None, however, could beat the extraordinary greeting I had this morning from Sam Cawthorn. If you've met Sam, it's a unique experience. He's the bloke who knows the serious meaning of a firm handshake." And he actually says, "I am still recovering from this and still in therapy."
Yes.
From the experience.
So, yes, I do now have bragging rights that I have put the Prime Minister into therapy.
Your right arm was amputated above the elbow, and you have this prosthetic now. Tell me a bit more about it. You said it actually has 7 motors. Where do the motors live in here, Sam?
Now, I've got a number of motors in the wrist part, so I can actually open my hand, close my hand.
Oh, I see.
Can also turn the wrist around and all the way around.
360! How do you do that? How do you actually do that?
So it's all controlled via my muscles and my nerves on the end of my, let's say on the end of my stump. So obviously the amputation is in between my elbow and my shoulder. I still do have various muscles that still do work, and I've got very small sensors inside the prosthetic arm. And so as I move the muscles, it'll operate the motors inside my hand and in my elbow.
So effectively you operate it the way you would an organic hand, by thinking, really. I mean, you think and your muscles move in your upper arm.
Yes, that's right.
And it can turn 360.
It is absolutely, and I can even do more things than what able-bodied hands and elbows can do. Correct.
That's fantastic. And how does it? Can you move it at the elbow the same way? Isn't this painful for you or anything? Is it?
No, look, it's not painful at all. The elbow is a conventional elbow. It's not a motorized elbow as such. However, I can bring the elbow all the way up to my face.
Wow.
And I can also obviously have my elbow straight out as well. Yeah.
What a brilliant thing. And is it battery powered or something, Sam?
It is battery powered. So I need to plug my arm in every night after I get home. I need to plug it in and recharge my arm.
What do you? Oh, there it is.
Yes.
So is that? Oh, okay. It's a special rechargeable battery.
Correct.
That you insert into the arm.
Yes.
What do you know about prosthetics research at the moment? Because this is really exciting branch of medicine at the moment. The way the advances that are being made in this sense.
Yeah. The Americans are spending a lot of money in prosthetics, and mainly because of the wars. There's a lot of army guys that are coming back, and there's a lot of investment in prosthetic legs, prosthetic arms, and the way that technology is moving, it's moving at a very, very fast, rapid pace. Already there are arms that can do possibly even more than what an able-bodied arm can do. Same with the legs as well.
So in 20 years' time, you may well have another prosthetic that makes this look like some kind of this state-of-the-art baby you got here. This might look like some, you know, ridiculous antique.
Absolutely, and I also read somewhere that in 20 years' time, the Paralympians will be able to overtake the able-bodied Olympians just simply from the way that technology is moving and the awesomeness of the prosthetic limbs.
And then you might become a show-off.
That's it.
Well, it's a fine-looking thing as well. What are the limitations of the prosthetic?
I mean, obviously, there are many, many limitations. I can't really grab something, bring it up to my mouth, or I can't use a knife or a fork or anything at all like that with my arm. Even though I can pick up things and hold things and everything like that, that's sort of the extent of my movement. Obviously, there is a whole strap and a whole harness to it, so it does need to come off of an evening. It does need to be recharged. So
once you get it off, do you go, oh, that's better?
Yes,
you do.
I do, yeah, for sure. Because it is actually quite tight. It has to be very, very tight fitting on the end of my stump, yeah.
And you said there are benefits to it. Being able to turn your hand 360 degrees is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Tell me about, do you get phantom pain? Do you still get that, or is that just something that's gone away now?
No, I always get phantom pain, actually, and it is quite painful. Sometimes in the middle of the night, it could wake me up because it is quite painful. So I can still feel every single one of my fingers. I can feel my wrist. I can feel my elbow. I feel as if it's all still there, but it's like having 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, really bad pins and needles in the end of my arm. And so, yeah, I sort of, after a while, you sort of train your brain to switch off to that pain, but it is always there.
I'm speaking with Sam Cawthorn. Sam is the Tasmanian Young Australian of the Year. He's my guest in conversation today. Sam, first of all, you've just returned from the international speaking circuit. You've just had an engagement in Delhi and Dubai, given that you've got Indian ancestry as well. Tell me about that, going to a place like Delhi. Was it the first time you've been there?
It was the first time I went to India. I mean, look, I've been to cities all over the world. I've been to New York, Tokyo, LA, obviously Sydney. I've been to London. Nothing will ever prepare you to go into India and see poverty firsthand and see just simply the way, the chaos, the organised chaos that you see in Delhi is quite amazing.
What about the other side of India, the fact that it's, well, you know, I suppose it's still booming despite the global financial crisis. It's still, I mean, what's its growth rate down to now? Just a mere, 6% or something like that. Do you still get a sense of its booming economy when you're there?
Oh, yeah. Look, all over the city, there's a brand new metro system coming in. There's a massive big international airport that's coming in, and especially that they're hosting the Commonwealth Games next year, they're putting a lot of infrastructure, especially into Delhi. But when you go outside of the metropolitan areas, when you go into the villages, very much so, it's still very older, traditional style of living.
And you still got family there in India?
Yeah, I do have family in Calcutta, actually, yeah.
Okay. Are you not made contact with them on this trip, but maybe another time?
Yeah, not in this trip. I am planning on going back towards the end of the year, and I will definitely be making contact with my mum's side in India. Yeah.
So tell me about the large family you come from, Sam. Give me that background.
So my father, he's Scottish, so he's got the whole red beard and the red hair. My mother, she's Indian, and they actually met in India. We moved over here to Australia in the 70s. And so obviously I was born here. I'm actually one of 11. So there are 7 boys and there are 4 girls. Actually, if you line up all of my brothers right here in the studio, you probably couldn't pick me out. We all look identical.
I think I'd pick you out with the arm.
Yes, I'm the only one with one arm.
that's true. So why Australia and why Tasmania of all places? That's an interesting thing for an Indian/Scottish family to go to.
Well, Dad was actually doing all his studies over here. He was doing boarding school and he obviously fell in love with the place. He actually then got citizenship and suppose the rest is history. He then convinced Mum to move over here. And initially we were all born in Western Australia. And then my brother, he actually came down to Tasmania when he was a young boy on a school trip. He absolutely loved the place. And so the entire family, within a year, all bussed down from Perth, Western Australia, down to Tasmania. And really, we've been there ever since. So I've done all my high school years down in Tasmania, done my college all in Tasmania.
And it wasn't just Tassie, it was country Tasmania. I mean, Tasmania might well be the least multicultural state in Australia, and the country Tasmania.
Argumentedly,
there isn't an Indian spice shop on the corner there. You have to go a long way to get a decent pakora from around there. How did your Scottish/Indian family do in country Tassie?
Well, it's interesting you say that. We were actually at a school. The school was maybe 300 people in the school. We were the only dark family in the entire school. So, yes, in country Tasmania, it was very, very unique, us being here involved, this dark Indian family. But, look, it was a great experience and obviously I had the support of my 6 brothers. It was good fun.
You're a tall guy as well, so I suppose you didn't get picked on that much, or did you get picked on that much?
Yeah, look, we did get picked on. We got picked on for our skin colour quite a bit. And look, there was this one instance, Richard. I actually was getting teased by a whole heap of guys at school, and at one stage they're actually chasing after me. And so here I am, I'm running through the school away from these, you know, these 3 or 4 blokes. And so I ran around the corner and all my brothers were actually all waiting there. And so as these 3 guys walked around the corner, they could see all 7 of us boys. And it was, you know, there was a lot of stories like that where, you know, obviously having a very large family, we're all very, very close. We're very supportive, great environment.
How was your Indian heritage as you grew up? Was it embraced or was it something that the family wanted to leave behind? Did you still retain a bit of the Indian culture, Indian food and the like in Tassie?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, my mum, obviously having a very large family of 11, you should see our smallest pot is like a 20-litre saucepan. and everything that we had, lunch and dinner, was curry-based. So whether or not it was papadums or dal or vindaloo or whatever it might be. So, look, we definitely did grow up in a very sort of strong Indian, Christian type environment.
Yeah, that's interesting. Tell me a bit about that aspect of things as well, because it was a reasonably strict Christian upbringing.
Yes.
At the same time. And what did that mean for you?
Look, that was obviously a, in a way, it was sort of a difficult time in my life, because we were actually forced to do various things. We were actually forced to get down on our knees and pray. We were forced to read the Bible and lift our hands up when we were singing and everything like that. So that was obviously very sort of confronting for us family, but then again, it was a culture that we were born into. So Dad actually initially came a Christian. He then converted Mum to become a Christian, and then they sort of lived a very traditional way. However, looking back at it now, Richard, without a doubt, I don't regret that time in my life at all. That instilled good, strong core morals and values in my life that could not be replaced.
it was bad enough in my household because my parents were strict ABC TV viewers.
Yeah.
And if I wanted to watch The $6 Million Man, I had to beg them on my hands and knees, and I still failed. Were you isolated from pop culture?
Yeah, very much so. Completely isolated. I mean, we weren't allowed to watch TV. And whenever we did watch TV, it was like a black and white golden oldie. And Mum and Dad would watch it first. They would delete the scenes where there might have been kissing or something like that. And then we'd all sit down as a family and watch it maybe once every month or something like that. So, yeah, it was a very, very different lifestyle.
Sam Cawthorn is my guest in conversation this morning. Sam is the Tasmanian Young Australian of the Year with an amazing personal story to tell. You left home at 15, Sam. You went off the rails a little bit for a while, did you? Tell me what happened.
Yeah, I did. Look, basically, obviously, being out in the country, we were very isolated out there. And as you're saying as well, you know, very isolated from pop culture. And so after finishing year 10, there was no colleges at all in the area. So I had a great excuse to obviously leave home, which is obviously what I really wanted to do. I went into Elizabeth College, which is down in Hobart. I went there for about 6 months, and I just was not used to being free in the real world. And so I was influenced in a very negative way. I started hanging out with quite bad, negative, influential people. And from there, they actually got me involved in drugs, and then I actually started dealing. It was just mainly marijuana, weed in school, and there was one stage there where the principal sort of came up and said, look, you know, we don't tolerate this at all. And so, yeah, he sort of actually asked me to leave. And so, yeah, so then that whole year after that was quite a difficult time. However, looking back at it now, I feel so blessed that I was pulled out of that, because the guys that I used to hang out with, one guy, he's actually has OD'd. And passed away. Another guy's actually in jail. Another guy's running from the law. These are the guys that I used to hang out with. So, yeah, I feel really, really blessed to be pulled out of that.
Yeah. Are you glad, nonetheless, you did have that period of, I don't know if it's worldliness is the word I'm looking for, but otherwise you'd be a bit of a babe in the woods, wouldn't you, if you hadn't actually seen another side of life? Because you were almost a street kid for a bit, you said, weren't you?
I mean, yeah. I was a street kid, and obviously now I do a lot of youth stuff. So in a way I can sort of understand what a lot of young people are going through, dealing with, you know, the pressures of society and the peer pressures from people, as well as when it comes into drugs as well. So I have a greater understanding of where they're coming from. And so, yeah, it was a great learning experience, and I would never regret anything in my life. It was there for a reason and a purpose, and obviously now I'm pulled out of that, and yes, I've actually learnt a lot from that. Yeah.
How about now the lessons you draw from that and bringing up your own kids? Mm. I don't know if you want to talk about that, but if you, there is the danger in isolating your children,
yes,
from the world,
yes,
because when they taste the world, they want to taste it all of a sudden, and there's not much balance there. I don't know. What do you conclude from all of that, Sam? Have you thought about that much?
Yeah, look, I think about it all the time, and I think there definitely does need to be a balance. You know, I mean, we allow our kids, you know, freedom to watch telly, and obviously we will filter certain. I won't let my 6-year-old watch Rage, for instance. However, you know, she can watch, you know, other shows that we watch as well. So I need to still have a balance. I cannot shield her from the world. She needs to learn for herself. At the same
time. Yeah, I don't want my 6-year-old daughter watching Christina Aguilera either. Particularly, that's not at 6 anyway.
Tell me about it. Yeah.
So you got a job working at Pizza Hut part-time? You're doing all that, delivering pizzas? So there you were, essentially a stoner pizza delivery guy. What happened? What changed?
Yeah, look, I was a bit of a stoner pizza guy, and look, I was there for Pizza Hut for a while, and then I actually met this girl, and her name was Kate, and my whole entire life just completely changed. After about a year of knowing her, she could see I was just drawn down by my mates and my friends, and so then she came up to me and she gave me a decision.
How did you actually meet her?
I initially met her at Elizabeth College. And so we were sort of on and off from Elizabeth College, and then I got this job at Pizza Hut, and again sort of on and off and that type of stuff. And then again I was hanging out with these guys, and so I'd sort of sometimes go out with her to her house, or I might go out into clubs or whatever it might be. And after a while we sort of worked on a really good relationship, but then she then gave me a decision. She said, look, Sam, it's either me or it's your friends. And that was a real defining point in my life. I had to really choose. And when I was when I was there, I was thinking, man, this is not right. This is selfish. You can't say that to me. But I now realise that it was the best thing that someone has ever done for me.
Well, what does that mean, though? Do you have to then front your mates and just say, like, I don't want to see you again, or do you just drop them, just not make contact with?
Look, in most cases, they weren't really real mates. You know, they were just acquaintances and
associates.
Really people that have drawn me down. And so in a lot of ways, it wasn't actually all that hard at all to actually disconnect them from my life and actually go then and hang out more with my partner.
Still, it's a big thing to do.
And it was.
What was so special about Kate?
Oh, look, she just captured my heart, you know. I mean, sometimes you just can't put the finger on it, but just things just gelled. Even though she's the completely opposite personality, she's an introvert, I'm an extrovert. She's like a melancholy phlegmatic, whereas I'm a sanguine choleric. And as they say, opposites attract. And we just completely attracted. And, you know, she's the love of my life. We're now married today. This is our 10th year and going very strong.
You got how old were you when you got engaged and married?
I got engaged when I was 19. I got married when I was 20. Yeah.
So how did you make that transition from stoner pizza, you know, delivery guy to responsible dad?
Well, actually, with my wife now, Kate, she obviously pulled me away from my friends, but still, I wasn't quite in my right frame of mind. You know, I was still smoking a little bit and everything like that. And then I met another guy. And he actually sort of said, look, you know, we've got this really cool, funky church. And it was one of those really happy, clappy churches. You know, when you go in and there's loud noise and there's a lot of young people there and they're jumping and screaming. I thought, man, this is pretty cool. And so I went in there and obviously, you know, I started to go along there regularly. I started to be part of that culture. And that actually really helped me in my transition from obviously not really embracing life to actually really embracing life to the full.
So you had a stint as a youth pastor for a while. What was that work like for you?
Youth pastor was great because I've actually really got a real heart for people, and obviously that had really come, let's say, from my Christian church background from those few years when we first got married. And so, I've got a real heart for young people and actually really engaging young people, empowering them, then releasing them. And so I thought a great vehicle for that was actually a youth pastor type role. And so here I was in Launceston, Tasmania, and I was a part of a church there. And, we were actually just engaging a lot of young people from both the streets, from a lot of schools and colleges. And at one stage there, we had a youth ministry, let's call it, up to 300 people in Launceston, which was the largest one in the whole of Lonnie.
And you were appointed as a youth futurist by the federal government of the day. What is a youth futurist, Sam?
Yeah, basically, what a youth futurist is, I was my actual title was a regional industry careers advisor. However, in saying that, it was very much so predicting what are the trends and what are the gaps that young people have today, and hopefully engaging them in various programs in order for their transition from school to either further education, training, employment. So I was very much so talking with employers and industries, finding out from them what are the trends, what are their needs in the future, and then communicating a lot of that information back through the school pathways. And so I was all part of this a new initiative by the federal government called Career Advice Australia. But I was very much so working on that higher level, all about predicting what are actually the trends of young people and what will they be facing in the future.
So there you are. I'm just wondering what vision you had for your own future at that stage. I suppose everything was on track and looking pretty good at that stage for you, Sam.
Yeah,
your career.
Also at the same time, I was doing a lot of other things. I was also a hip-hop dance teacher, so I was actually teaching dance.
Seriously? Really?
That was so cool. So I also did a lot of productions, and I was teaching out at schools and also for adult education. I was also a singing teacher and vocal coach, so I've been classically trained, and so I had my own little studio at home, and I was actually teaching up to 100 students, both through adult education, through schools, as also my own little studio at home. So I was doing a number of other little things as well.
So you're an extremely busy guy.
At the time I was absolutely flat out. So I had a full-time job, I was a youth pastor, I had a family of two at the time, I had hip-hop dancing, singing and everything like that. So, yeah, it's full on.
How did the accident happen, Sam? How did that actually take place?
This was in, it was in October 2006. And I remember the day so clearly, you know. As I always do, you know, I got up and said goodbye to my girls, and I was actually driving from Launceston up through to Burnie first, and I was I actually had a few meetings up along the way, and then up there in Burnie, I actually had a lunch meeting there at one of my favourite places I like to eat, which is right there on the waterfront. Great restaurant, great company. It was called KFC. And from KFC, I actually then went through to Devonport, and it was about 10, 15 metres minutes out of Devonport, a place called Parramatta Creek. Now, it was my fault. I veered on to the wrong side of the road, and it was a head-on collision with a semi-trailer.
Why did you veer? Did you fall asleep?
Yeah,
can you remember? Can you even remember?
I don't remember those 10 minutes from leaving Devonport to Parramatta Creek. I reckon I did fall asleep. The police also said they don't know 100%, but they said they also reckon I fell asleep, veered onto the wrong side of the road, and it was a 206K impact. So I was going 104 and the truck was going 102.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Today, my guest in conversation is Sam Cawthorne. Sam is the Tasmanian Young Australian of the Year for 2009. He's in the business of motivation these days. Sam arrived in Australia. He didn't arrive in Australia. He was born here with parents who came here from India and Scotland. And Sam suffered a terrible car accident some years ago, and you're just hearing the story about that. Sam, just quickly before we pick that up, you neglected to mention in our conversation right at the start about the stuff you can do with this prosthetic arm and hand of yours. You can crush a glass with your prosthetic hand. This is true?
This is absolutely true.
I'd ask you to do it with the glass that's in front of you, except it's full of water and I don't know what had happened, but in the studio. Do you do that on stage sometimes?
Yeah, look, I do it in stage, and the kids, they absolutely love it. The students, they sort of don't believe me at first, and then when I start, and then when the glass just cracks, especially even a glass bottle, they absolutely love it.
That's Terminator stuff, isn't it?
It is Terminator stuff.
All right, that's just a little minor detour. Sam, just before the headlines, you were telling me about the accident, how you veered onto the side of the road. We're not really quite sure what happened. It was probable that you may have just gotten fatigue or fallen asleep. What were you driving in at the time? Do you remember?
Yeah, I was driving my my company car, which is a large V8 Holden Statesman. Now the airbag it did deploy, and I actually believe that saved any major head injuries at all in the accident, yeah.
What do you remember of that collision with the semi-trailer? What can you remember anything of it, Sam?
The only thing I do remember is just the loud bang. I don't remember anything at all prior to it. The police, though, said that 20 metres before impact, I did put my foot on the brake because they could see skid marks. Now, I don't remember doing that at all. I don't remember the truck coming towards me. And even talking to the truck driver after, he said he thought that I was committing suicide. Because if you think about it, here's a truck going 100 k's, here's a guy coming 100 k's towards you on the other side of the road, right towards a large semi-trailer truck. He thought I was committing suicide.
He must have been frightened out of his mind as well, the poor truck driver, once he collided with him. What happened at that point of impact? Your car must have crumpled like a tin can.
Yeah, look, obviously the truck driver, he was fine. But yeah, I completely, the impact actually hit the driver door mainly. So it was the front on the driver's side. I spun around, and then there was also another car that was behind the truck, and he actually hit me right in the driver's door. So it was actually two cars involved in the accident.
What happened after that?
After that, obviously being on a main highway, so there was a lot of cars that had stopped, and a lot of cars are running over towards my car mainly.
Were you still in the car?
I was still in the car. I'll give you an idea of the impact. The steering wheel of the car was underneath the passenger seat. Also, the police said that my elbow was ripped from my arm and was around 25 metres away from the car.
What other damage did you sustain to your body, Sam?
There was quite a bit of other damage. I also had broken 6 ribs. I'd also had a lacerated liver, a punctured kidney, and I also had lost a lot of my leg as well. So I lost a lot of bone, and I and the doctor said I literally lost my entire quad on the road. I also had broken my femur, my knee, my fibula, my ankle, and get this, Richard, I lost my large toenail.
I'm amazed that's included on the injury list. It's were you were conscious for part of that time, weren't you?
Yeah, look, I actually remember everything from that loud bang, which I believe was the second car hitting my door. I actually remember everything from that moment. I remember people running over to the car. I remember seeing their lips move, but I couldn't hear them speak at all because my ears were still ringing from the loud impact. I remember something very clearly, and this is really full on. I remember the look that they gave me sitting there in the car, and it was a look that I'll never, ever forget. So here there would be maybe 10, 15 people standing outside my car, and the look was, this guy is not going to make it. They could see the condition of my arm, the condition of my leg, the condition of my chest. They could see a lot of obviously, you know, red stuff all around and lots of my body. And that look I would just never, ever forget from so many people.
Was there pain, or did the shock just keep that at bay for a while?
Yeah, there was like shock and pain. And, yeah, look, there was a lot of pain. I do remember finding it extremely hard to breathe. I remember my entire body, I just felt as if it was just collapsing. I was sitting in the car for quite a while, and I then remember that there was a lady that was sitting next to me in the passenger seat. There was another lady behind me just holding my head up, making sure, obviously, there was no other injuries to my neck or anything like that. And they was talking to me. They were asking me what day of the week it was, where I was heading, what time I thought it was, what actually had happened that day. They were talking to me about my kids, and they said I was still very awake and very alert. They said I still knew where I was heading. They said I still knew what day of the week it was. Mobile numbers, I knew absolutely everything. And I was yelling out, I remember, and they told me as well since. They said I was yelling out my wife's mobile number. Ring my wife, ring my wife. This is her number, this is her number. So there was it was quite intense, you know, those initial 5-10 minutes from impact.
And then you lost consciousness.
Yeah, look, apparently it took around 20 minutes for the ambulance to come.
So you're on a country road, weren't you?
No, it was a country road. However, it was a main highway there from Launceston to Devonport. It was about 20 minutes before the ambulance came, and I remember the noise of the ambulance, the siren, and that was the last thing I remember. I then passed out, and then I was told that I'd stopped breathing, and my heart had also stopped as well. I was then told the ambulance guys quickly came over, resuscitated me right there and then. And then I was then told that the jaws of life came, cut me out of the car, put me in the ambulance and took me back to the hospital.
The timing on that's interesting, isn't it? Do you think you were really fighting to hang on? And then once you heard the sirens, you thought, I can let them take over now for a bit?
I wonder. Yeah, I think you're right, Richard. I completely think you're right. And also me being a Christian, you know, I actually fully believe that, you know, that that God was there with me, you know, because I was actually calling out to God, you know, save me, because I thought I was going to die. I actually did think. I thought, oh, I'm going to die here. I was telling my rescuers, look, tell my kids I love them. Tell my wife, you know, I love her so much. I was telling them this. And so then I was, you know, sort of crying out to God to just sort of help me. And in these type of situations, you know, what else can you turn to? So I actually believe that God was there with me. And I actually believe that I'm alive today because of my faith in God and how he had come and to my rescue.
You lost the arm. You lost the arm above the elbow.
Yep.
That was obviously not retrievable. It looked like you might lose your leg at one point too, didn't it?
Yeah, look, actually, my arm was still attached when I was in hospital, and I remember the doctor, he sort of woke me up when I was in hospital, and he goes, Sam, And I said, yeah. And the doctor said, we're going to have to amputate your right arm. And I said to the doctor, you're joking. And the doctor said, no, look, we don't normally joke about this type of stuff. And so I actually remember that quite clearly. That was one of my first operations.
Yeah, doctors don't say that and then go, just jerking
your chain, man.
Yeah,
joking.
Yeah, just pulling your leg on that one, no.
Yeah, and so then my leg, there was actually three out of the four doctors that were there. They actually said, look, we think we should take his leg off. And that fourth doctor said, no, look, I reckon I could save it. And so here I am. I've still got my leg. There's still major issues with my leg, but I've actually still got it.
What did you lose from the leg?
I lost a lot of bone. As I was saying, I lost my entire quad on the road.
Which muscle is that?
That's the one just above your knee.
Right.
So that...
There's your phone. There's someone ringing to tell you you're on the conversations, I think. That could be it, Sam.
Jonty Bush.
It's actually Jonty ringing to say you're on conversations. Jonty, leave him alone for a bit. He'll be done in a sec.
Yes, so I have actually lost I lost my entire quad, which is all the four muscles that are above my knee. And so that is one of the main reasons why I cannot bend my knee at all. So even if they replace my knee and the componentry in my kneecap and everything like that, I still will not be able to bend my knee ever because I lost my entire engine room to the knee, which is obviously the four muscles above the kneecap, which is the quad.
Do you remember that moment, waking up in hospital thinking, oh, I'm alive? Or is that still a bit vague and blurry?
The only thing I do remember was obviously the doctors asked me that question. The next thing I remember was actually 7 days later after waking up from an induced coma. The entire family was right there by my side. It was a very, very emotional time for me, just sort of realising what had happened. Because all the stuff that I've told you now since that large bang, I actually didn't remember initially. There are actually flashbacks that came to me a few days after I'd actually woken up from a coma.
So you had no idea what had happened to you until someone told you?
That's exactly right. I had no idea at all. I just thought I was just waking up from a sleep. And then all of a sudden they were saying, hey, Sam, you've lost your arm. Hey, Sam, you've just had an accident. I actually didn't know.
It's quite common for people who suffer these accidents, once they've survived it or gone through, you know, this process of being badly banged up, they go through protracted depression. Did that happen to you?
Honestly, no. It actually did not happen to me at all. Yes, I was actually...
Not at all. No, you went... You would have been entitled to be a bit blue for a bit about this.
Yeah, but not necessarily depression, though. Yes, I was very frustrated. I thought, why did this happen to me? Why couldn't it have happened to the car behind me? Why couldn't it have happened to someone else? And so obviously I had all these questions. I was frustrated. I was annoyed. I didn't know why this had happened. And then after that, when I really realised it had happened after about 2 or 3 days after waking up from a coma, because initially I thought, look, I'm just in a dream. I'm going to wake up from this. I'm just in a movie, you know. And then once I really realised, yeah, look, there were some really sad moments there, and I remember crying and crying, days and days of crying and going through pillow after pillow from my tears and all that. But I never went to that place of dark depression as such. Because as soon as I then realised, look, this is now the life I need to live. What is it going to prove me just feeling sorry for myself? What is it going to prove me just only living with not my most dominant arm, but I've still got one arm and one good leg. There are other people that have turned out to be jelly or lost their life or in a wheelchair. So I feel so blessed that I can still walk today, that I can still travel all around the world and talk, and I've still got a brain and everything like that. Look, I feel really blessed.
Often another thing that people find in this situation is that they need to cheer up the people around them. They've got to be strong for the people. Like, you've had the accident, but you've got to be strong for other people around you who are terribly upset. Was it like that for you?
Yeah, look, it was very much so like that, especially my wife, you know. We'd been married at the time for 6 years. It was really, really hard, you know, because she actually had driven past, when she was going to the hospital, she drove past the accident. So she saw my car driving past it. She did see a lot of the, you know, a lot of the stuff that was sort of on the road and inside the car. So that would have been really hard for her. And then obviously seeing me in that coma for the first 7 days in the coma, and the doctors actually every night coming to her and saying, look, we don't know if Sam's going to make it through tonight. That would have been extremely hard for her. So coming out of a coma, you know, we had many sort of nights together where we were just both in tears and that type of stuff. But after a while, she was really supportive, you know. She had a lot of support from my parents, from her parents, from my family.
How old were your daughters then, Sam? Were they too little to know what had happened to you?
My younger one was. I think she was only one or two years old. But my older one was. She was about four. And she was definitely alert and very knew exactly what had happened. And that was a real amazing moment. I remember her coming into the hospital room and she jumped up on the bed and I was just in tears seeing my daughter for the first time. And she said to me, she goes, Daddy, did you have an accident? And I said, yes, I had an accident. She goes, and you lost your arm? And I said, yeah, I lost my arm. And she goes, and the doctors, they couldn't find it anywhere, Daddy.
Oh, those doctors. They're careless with the arms, aren't they?
You just got to love the way that young little girls, how they see life, you know. It was just beautiful.
Where's the warranty on this thing? Tasmanian Young Australian of the Year, Sam Cawthorn, is my guest this morning. And the rehabilitation, I don't suppose we need to go too much detail about that, but I can imagine painful, long, horrible physiotherapy, all of that, Sam.
Yeah, look, it was really full on because initially the doctor said, look, Sam, your right leg is never going to get better. You probably won't be able to walk ever again. I was in hospital for 5 months. I was in a wheelchair for 12 months because obviously I can't use crutches because I've only got one arm. So, yeah, that was a real difficult time in my life, obviously just trying to understand that I'm going to be in a wheelchair for the rest of my life.
Oh, that was the expectation, was it?
That was the expectation, yeah, that I was going to be in a wheelchair for my entire life, that the doctors didn't know 100% if I was going to walk. So I had to, it was probably more of a mindset. I'm thinking here, I'm not going to take what the doctors say. I'm going to press into my rehabilitation. So it was very intense.
How's your spine? Was your spine damaged in the injury?
No, it wasn't damaged at all, which was obviously a huge... Initially, they thought that there was a major issue with my spine. But, yeah, it was obviously just... I damaged my hip a little bit, and obviously my entire right leg was just in complete shatters.
And right from the get-go, I suppose, once you were conscious, you were told you could have a prosthetic for your arm. What was that like to actually have it arrive? You know, here's your new arm. The idea of a new arm arriving in the mail or something is an interesting idea. And to cast eyes upon this prosthetic, putting it on and make it work for you, Sam.
Look, having an arm for the first time was really, really weird because all of a sudden, you know, you have no arm and then you've got this sort of this plastic thing or this metal thing that's just hanging off the end of a limb and you think, what is this here for? And so after a while, you sort of get to realize that, okay, look, I sort of do have a second hand, but I sort of don't. And yeah, there's a lot of mindset things that you sort of have to overcome in order to get used to having an arm where it's not really your arm. Yeah.
So you were rehabilitated. You got the power to walk back. And like you say, your leg's stiff, but you do walk around and yeah. You're fine. And may I make the observation, sir, you're in incredibly good shape too. You're quite muscular. You're obviously working out at a gym to keep yourself in good shape. What was different for your life out of rehabilitation, now being back in the world? Was it picking up where you left off, Sam? It doesn't really sound like you've, in a funny way, it doesn't sound like you were fundamentally changed by this. Or am I wrong in saying that?
My character and my personality, I think that's actually grown since my accident. However, my career and what I was doing has very much so changed. Because if you think about it, I was playing the guitar, I was playing the piano, I was dancing and skipping and running and jogging and everything like that. And now all of a sudden, you know, being in a wheelchair at the time for a year, and now obviously still finding it very hard to walk, hard to even sit down in a normal chair, hard to find a seat in the theatre that'll accommodate me, hard to get a seat on a plane. It's completely changed my lifestyle in that particular sense. And obviously now only having one arm, which is your non-dominant arm, just little things like cleaning your teeth, you know, getting that really, really fast action motion with your hand, it's actually quite hard.
Theatre director Jim Sharman, when he was on Conversations, told me that he spent quite a bit of time as a young teenager in bed sick, and he said he thinks the role of convalescence in youth is underrated. He says so much of his creative development as a human being came from that time when he was stuck in bed and ill or stuck in his room. What changed in you? Did you feel ideas bombing, that the protracted period of meditation you go through when you have to stay in bed or in convalescence for a long time? So.
Yeah, first of all, staying in bed leads to frustration, and frustration can be your worst enemy or your best enemy, because frustrating can actually also lead to change or lead to you doing something about it. And that's exactly what it was for me. I was frustrated. Here's this person that had so many things going on in his life, and then all of a sudden being confined to a bed. Help me! So it was very much so. I had to start thinking, okay, what can I do here in bed? What can I put my hands to? What can I keep my mind active on?
I must make something.
Yes.
And you made something.
I did indeed. So those 5 months of being in hospital and those 12 months of being in a wheelchair, I actually then launched my business. I have a lot of different arms to my business, but the main arm is my youth work, which is called Be Motivated.
And what does that mean?
Be Motivated is all about equipping, inspiring, and then empowering young people in their life and in their journey, whatever it might be. And so my heart, again, is to really equip this next generation of people to be resilient, to be encouragers, to be people that can actually rise up and be the next leaders in tomorrow's world.
You worry you might be setting a bad example sometimes, given that you will sometimes crush a glass with your prosthetic arm, making kids think, gee, I wish I had one of those. Is there a danger with that?
Actually, I've even heard one guy say, man, I'm so jealous of your arm. I wish I had that.
Sam Cawthorn is my guest this morning. He's the Tasmanian Young Australian of the Year. And how have you found that, reliving the accident, as you've just done, and I'm sure you do when you're giving these speeches all over the world? Yeah, does it get less painful in the retelling? Was it initially painful to recount what you went through, Sam?
Yeah, look, I remember the first time I was talking about the accident. It was actually at a church, and I was just telling about my story, and there was a couple of times there where I actually had to pause because there was just tears welling up in my eyes. So yeah, for sure, it was hard in those initial times and that type of stuff. But also, it's been a good healer for me. The more that you talk about things, the more easier it also becomes, but also the more healing that you'll get from it.
Are you still finding more bits to the puzzle? Finding out, you say you're getting flashbacks, and that's helped you put that story together in your head. And as you get older, I'm sure you'll have a greater understanding of some of the other deeper issues that you went through at the time. Is that story still a growing one for you?
Yeah, look, for sure. Those questions that I was saying before, why did this happen to me? Why me? Why not someone else? I'm starting to realise that things do happen for a reason. Someone asked me, if you went back to that moment, would you choose not to drive in front of that truck?
Yeah. The answer is yes, surely. I'm sorry, it has to be yes, doesn't it?
Well, that's the thing. Look, who am I to play God? I actually think that things happen for a reason. And so, look, if that was God's will, me not driving in front of a truck, yeah, I'd change it. But this is the way that
That's a
I
hard
believe.
Game to play, though.
It's very hard. But we can't sort of say, look, if I could go back, I'd change the way I'd do life. I'd change the way. Look, this is the way I am today, and I'm accepting it, and I'm moving forward. I don't want to look back.
You can play guitar. You can actually play guitar with this prosthetic arm. How? How do you do it?
I have this awesome prosthetic guitar arm, which is a complete different arm.
Oh, a customised thing. Right.
It is a complete customised thing. And so obviously with my left hand, you've got the actual chords and all that. But with my right arm, you only really do the strumming. So I've got this special type of arm that just sort of a little hooks around, and I can strum and I can play very well. I'm actually playing on stage this weekend in Sydney.
Wow. And you can actually, it is effective. It's not, you're not sort of, you obviously can't finger pick, but you can strum pretty effectively with it. It works on a spring type thing or something?
No, look, it's basically I work it all through my shoulder. So my shoulder actually does all the strumming. And yeah, look, I can strum actually quite well, and I can actually also do a lot of different types of rhythm. So, look, I love it, and it was so good to play the guitar again. I really missed playing the guitar because I've been playing it ever since I was a young boy. But playing it now, love it to bits.
And Sam, subsequently, you've got another child in the family, a boy now, a son. Wow. You just keep piling up the workload, don't you?
My surgeon says, look, Sam, I actually don't remember putting that in your rehabilitation plan. And it's also good to know that things still do work. But yeah, look, he is awesome, my little boy. He just laughs, he giggles. I love spending time with him. Family is obviously very important to me, a lot more important to me now after accident than sort of was. I'm not saying it wasn't as important to me, but now I realise the importance of healthy relationships, of family. Now, because I'm looking at the world in a whole different light. I believe I was brought back from the dead for a reason and a purpose. And so, yeah, now here I am loving my kids to bit, Rich, yeah.
And the experience of being made Tasmanian Young Australian of the Year, tell me what that's like for you, because I've been involved peripherally with the Australia Day Council over the last couple of years. The pleasure of that is, for me, is meeting the award winners, the finalists, people such as yourself. They're a really diverse group of people, and they're good conversationalists. What's that been like for you, being with that select group of people, Sam?
Yeah, look, for sure, it has been amazing. Like, I remember just meeting the guys there. Even, like, we can talk about the celebrities like Glenn McGrath and Adam Gilchrist and those guys, but, like, even people like Jonty Bush and other just amazing people that are just sort of quiet people in their own right that have achieved so much in their communities or in their state. So, look, it has been awesome just meeting these guys. Ever since then, I've actually now going out to them and starting to interview them and actually finding out from them what are their, how they had that transition from school to employment, and start communicating that through my youth channels and what I do in my business. So, love it. It was one of the most amazing opportunities for me.
Sam, it's been great meeting with you, and fascinating. You're the only man I've ever had on this program who can crush a glass with a prosthetic arm. That's been great to meet you. Thank you so much for being with me in conversation today.
Great. Thanks again. Thank you.
That's Sam Cawthorn, Tasmanian Young Australian of the Year.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.